From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week, we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C., your nation's capital that's colder than a refrigerator. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you. Please visit stateofbelief.com and help keep this show on the air. Now, here's what's coming up this week.
The most dangerous passage in the Hebrew Bible. In the book of Deuteronomy, the God of the Torah is reminding us throughout it that it is the special duty of community to look after those people who have no other economic resources. So why aren't the biblical literalists talking about this all the time?
The Reverend Michael Ehlich is a young, dynamic faith leader who helps lead a dizzying variety of spiritual and social programs at Judson Memorial Church in New York City. His ministry centers around the pursuit of new theological forms for expressing the truths of the gospel for what he calls the post-Christian world, and expressions of those truths that range from service to activism to contemplative solitude. As we continue our series titled A Prophetic Vision for a New Year, Where We're Going, How We'll Get There, Reverend Ehlich's work in faithfully sparking positive change is the reason he'll be with us later on in this week's show.
So what gives my life meaning? I'd like to say being editor of On Faith, but I have to say that editing a website is about as spiritual as being on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange.
The work of Washington Post writer Sally Quinn has long influenced the national dialogue on topics of religion. Now, with the relaunch of the On Faith website under the auspices of faithstreet.com. A recent column posted on the site headlined, I Was an Angry Atheist, Why I Launched and Relaunched On Faith, contains powerful reminders of why responsible, respectful dialogue about religion is always relevant. And Sally Quinn will be with us later on this week's show.
Leviticus 20:13 states, if a man also lie with mankind as he lieth with a woman, they shall surely put him to death. I brought the first stone, Mr. Webb, in case that your Bible talk isn't just a smokescreen for personal prejudices.
That's Pamela Raintree confronting a city council member at a Shreveport, Louisiana public meeting. The council member had introduced a bill to repeal a new non-discrimination ordinance, and Pamela, a transgender woman, used Leviticus and a big old rock to deflate his attempt at supposedly Bible-based lawmaking. John Dennison of the Louisiana Forum for Equality has been busy promoting local non-discrimination ordinances statewide, as well as dealing with the recent Duck Dynasty controversy. And I'm going to be talking with John in just a few minutes. But first, Pam, I want to welcome you to State of Belief Radio. You're a courageous woman.
Well, thank you.
What you did was phenomenal. Tell the story, if you will.
Well, Mr. Webb had made references to the Bible to justify the homophobic rant and discrimination.
Uh-huh.
And he used the word abomination, which we know is biblical.
Uh-huh.
But he went on to say that the Bible tells us not to associate with homosexuals, and I just couldn't tolerate the deception. So I brought the Bible verse that really applies, which comes from the Old Testament, and reminded him that what the Bible calls for is for stoning to death of homosexuals.
Mm-hmm.
And I offered him a stone to begin with, which I had the foresight to quote John 8:7 on there, which is the verse where Jesus says, he who is without sin cast the first stone. So I put it back in the Christian context for him.
And you plopped down a pretty big stone, from what I heard.
Well, it was a good fist-sized stone.
And so what happened after that?
Well, he asked the council to take his repeal measure off of the agenda, and they agreed unanimously to do that.
Listen, before that event, had you seen yourself as such a successful activist?
No. I've been an activist for 25 years, and my successes have been mediocre at best.
Well, you did a whopper here. What were you feeling when you stood before that council and did this?
Well, there was a little bit of fear there that someone might actually pick that stone up and carry out what the Bible said. There was at least one fundamentalist preacher in the room who had spoken rather viciously at every council meeting that had anything to do with gay rights.
Mm-hmm. Pam, what would you say to other people who see religion being perverted for political purposes, but who say to themselves, I couldn't ever do what she did. I don't think I could ever stand up and challenge that. What would you say to them?
Well, I say, yes, you can. Yeah. I have been challenging bullies my entire life, going all the way back to the early 1960s. And every bully I have ever faced has backed down because they're more afraid than I am. That's why they're bullies.
Yeah. Oh, that is such a great insight. What are the lessons from this experience that every one of us need to draw from?
I think we need to really be honest with our ideals and recognize when other people aren't and challenge them to be honest.
Yeah. So what's been the reaction that you've received there in Shreveport?
Well, I've been covered by the local TV station. I've had a couple of interviews lined up for local radio and TV, and I've gotten hundreds of messages on my Facebook account and friend requests from all over the world. And I think someone is planning for a speaking tour for me. So I'm not sure what the future is going to hold. It belongs to the public right now.
Well, that's great. And I want you to know, as a fellow Louisianian who lives just up the road, that I am so proud of you for what you did. And I know a lot of other people that are too. And you did it with such genius, not disrespecting the other person's religion or point of view, but calling their hand on what it means. I mean, it was absolutely brilliant.
Well, thank you. I grew up in a fundamentalist faith and was taught how to address the public in that tradition. So I just responded in kind.
Well, I am sure thankful. The news video has been all over the internet. Earlier this month, Pamela Raintree successfully defended the new non-discrimination ordinance in Shreveport, Louisiana, against one council member's attempt to repeal it based on his interpretation of the Bible. Now, you need to see this. You can go to stateofbelief.com and you can see something that will inspire you. I promise. Pam, as I said, I'm proud of you. I really appreciate you spending a little time with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Later in today's show, the Reverend Michael Ehrlich of Judson Memorial Church in New York City will be here for the latest installment of our series, A Prophetic Vision for a New Year. Where we're going, how we'll get there. And Washington Post religion writer Sally Quinn. She's about to help relaunch the influential website On Faith. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. I know the very idea of non-discrimination ordinances protecting LGBT persons in Louisiana is likely to surprise some of you. A lot of the credit, though, for that goes to the great work of the Louisiana Forum for Equality Foundation and its tireless executive board chair, John Dennison. So I am so happy to welcome John to State of Belief Radio. John, welcome.
Thank you, Welton. It's always a pleasure.
Now, I have to tell you all, I don't have to, but I want to tell you, this is a good friend of mine. We've known each other a long time and been down a lot of roads together.
Indeed,
John, yeah. How widespread is the movement for these kinds of protections for sexual minorities across Louisiana?
Well, then we have found that in the wake of the Shreveport Be Fairness Ordinance vote, Baton Rouge has requested some of the same language that was used in Shreveport. We have elected officials in Lafayette and other cities around the state that are asking us for information. And we've already spoken to several editorial board members of our major newspapers in the state who are very interested in these quality of life issues for their home cities. For the newspaper to contact us to say that if you do this, we'll support you, well, that's pretty big in Louisiana. Usually it's the other way around. We have to go to them and ask for support.
Absolutely. Talk about the work of the Louisiana Forum for Equality Foundation in promoting these issues.
Well, what we're trying to do this year, Welton, is look for sort of an omnibus anti-discrimination bill where it comes down to employment and to public accommodations. Forum, which has been around for about 25 years, has pushed in many legislative sessions an Employment Non-Discrimination Act that would only cover state employees. Now, we haven't had to do that every year because under Governors Edwin Edwards and Kathleen Blanco, there were executive orders that were signed that protected state employees from being fired if they were lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. But that all stopped with the administration of Bobby Jindal, who refused to renew that executive order. So it makes our push for legislation to fight non-discrimination that much more to the forefront. We've done these state employee bills, and we've gotten very little traction over the years. In fact, sometimes they didn't get out of committee. The very few times they did, they went down pretty quickly on the floor. So this year, we're moving to a much broader scope and calling it the Louisiana Non-Discrimination Act, or LANA. And what we're going to do this year, Welton, is we're going to revise almost 70 existing Louisiana laws to protect the LGBT community from discrimination, particularly employment, housing, public accommodations, even criminal investigations, by adding the language sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression to those laws.
I know you get a lot of opposition. Are all of the opponents of this kind of non-discrimination bill basing their arguments on religion?
Virtually all of the arguments against this are based in some sort of fundamentalist religious language. I'll give you a good example. When this bill came up for a vote last year, again, we're talking about only protecting state employees. We had our opponents say that the measure would advance what they called a sexual political agenda, and that it would give special protections to people who, as they put it, choose a lifestyle that violates biblical teachings. Their spokesperson said that this does not remedy an existing problem, and it opens the gate for, you know, potential litigation. As he put it, he said, people can't choose their race or gender, but they can leave what he said was the gay lifestyle. We don't hear anybody say what's truthful here except us, and that is, This doesn't open a floodgate of legislation. In fact, it prevents legislation. People who are discriminated against because of their sexual orientation or gender identity can certainly sue those employers. Employers would do well to see that this actually protects them. But no, Welton, other than those loud voices that keep harping against the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community here and in many other states, no one is lining up with any solid political or even legislative reasons to oppose this.
Yeah. What do you find to be the most effective way to defend civil rights legislation against attacks that hide behind the language of faith.
It's incumbent upon us who are LGBT, Welton, to be out. That's the best way I believe we can defend it. Unfortunately, not everybody can, and so that gives people like me who can lend a voice, and people like Pam Raintree, who so eloquently gave a voice in that Shreveport City Council meeting, it gives us that much more responsibility to speak for those who don't have voices.
Yeah.
Only when these legislators and our detractors can put a face to the message will they quit saying that we have a gay agenda and that we're activists, but they see that they were actually members of churches and their neighbors and their coworkers, and they can see that we are real people, too, who are being hurt.
I was so amazed and pleased by Pam Raintree. She talked eloquently. What's the role for average citizens in all of this? I mean, I'm convinced had she not done what she did, it would have been a different scenario in Shreveport.
It may very well have been. And fortunately for Pam and those who were supporting this measure in Shreveport, Forum for Equality, the foundation, along with PACE, which is People Acting for Change and Equality, the local group in Shreveport, have been working for the last 2 years on an awareness campaign and an education campaign. Pam came out of that and gave her very heartfelt testimony, both in December when the ordinance was originally passed, and again in January when we had to go back and defend it from a possible repeal effort. The people who are hearing us then and today, the people who, as we call them, are everything from our great straight allies to our families, you too can be supportive by speaking out when you see these injustices. So many times people are afraid to say anything, or they're afraid to sort of stick their neck out for fear that they too might be the subject of reprisals and targeted for their beliefs. But we're in this together, people. And let me tell you, the more that we have our great straight allies in the LGBT fight for equality, the more we are an equal population in these United States.
Mm. Well said. John, we both spoke out publicly after the recent Duck Dynasty debacle. A&E reinstated Phil Robertson pretty quickly after initially suspending him for his published anti-gay comments. But the show took, looks like, a fairly significant ratings hit. About over 3 million viewers were lost at the start of the new season. What can all of us learn from this whole thing?
It can be hard for the religious right, apparently, to remember that words hurt. People need to learn that words hurt. And especially when they are uttered either in print or in broadcast by somebody who is acting, and I use that term very deliberately, acting in a, quote, reality show that draws several million people.
Mm-hmm.
Phil Robertson has a very big and wide soapbox from which to preach his hate. And that's just hate speech, what he said in that GQ article.
Yeah.
And I think it was necessary for the debate for LGBT rights for something like this to happen. We knew, those of us who live in Monroe, we knew that this was going to happen sooner or later, because I've seen earlier videos where he was preaching this kind of hate and intolerance. And so it was just a matter of time before the nation as a whole, or indeed the world, because Duck Dynasty is shown around the world. It was just a matter of time before they saw it as well. If you want to see a reality show, come and watch the real news of the day unfold, as it did when I've anchored the news in Monroe for 30 years. That was reality. The reality is that I'm a gay Christian who is trying to make a better life for myself and for other people, especially those who don't have voices. And those are the people that Phil Robertson has really, really hurt, the people who don't have the ability to speak up and say, don't say this against me. It's hurtful. I've spoken to several members of the lesbian and gay community in Monroe since the dust-up of Duck Dynasty, and they are very reluctant to speak out publicly for even their own basic rights to be heard. Now, that's just a shame when what this man's hate speech quieted a whole group of people and made them fear for their lives.
John, I appreciate you being with us. I hope you'll let us know when Louisiana Forum for Equality Foundation is doing this kind of work again and again so we can keep on covering it. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Welton. We'll definitely keep you posted.
The prophetic work of Judson Memorial Church in New York City is absolutely nothing new. But the eternal challenge for faith communities of all types in our hyper-stimulated, fast-changing society is to engage new generations of people while staying true to the timeless truths of their core teachings and to find ways to affect positive change in the world around us. Stepping up to this challenge in remarkably innovative ways is the Reverend Michael Ehrlich, minister of Judson Memorial. And I'm very pleased to welcome Michael to State of Belief Radio. Michael, welcome.
Welcome. Good to be here.
You've got a very full plate.
That is the truth.
So if we could start with the context in which you're doing your work, you talk about ministry in a post-Christian world. What comes to your mind when you use that term?
Well, we're seeing a breakdown of, on one level, the old Christian narratives more and more. The burden on the church is to maintain its relevancy, as you say so well. So on one hand, you can't take it for granted that people are filling up the pews in the same way that you used to.
Mm-hmm.
We're also living in a world where more and more religious voices beyond just the old Christian ones are coming up to the fore, and Christianity is in dialogue in a way that it's never been before. But I got to tell you, the exciting part of this is that movement, that shift, is going along with something else that I think is, in its own way, core Christian. There is a spiritual revival going on in this country, unlike anything that I could have imagined even 10 years ago, where the old notions of prosperity gospel, the old Christian assumptions around prosperity gospel are breaking down, and people are remembering that the Christian gospel has always been something that's for the poor and oppressed. Now, it's for everybody, but that Christian spirituality is primarily puts an emphasis on the poor and oppressed in our community. And so on one hand, you're seeing the breakdown of certain narratives, but to my mind, what you're seeing on the ground is a revival of the gospel at its most fundamental and amazing core.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I get to experience every day here at Judson, and it's a treat. It's a privilege.
Michael, part of your mission is to establish a new Christian vocabulary. Now, I understand that some people will hear that and think this is a very aesthetic kind of concern for a minister, but you're trying to get us to move beyond traditional words and concepts. Talk about it and give us some specific illustrations of it.
Let me use a good example that I think gets to the core of a lot of this. A guy called me and had read a sermon I had done online or seen it on YouTube, and I don't want to say his name. We'll call him Daniel. He's calling from the Sacramento Valley. And he told me this story. He said that my grandfather came here and he owned a cherry tree farm. And that farm sustained my family. We worked hard. We went to church. We did everything we were supposed to do, and we believed. And again, this is that old prosperity gospel narrative.
Mm-hmm.
We believe that if we did all these things, treated our neighbor well, that God would bless us. And what he said was that his father's generation, the economy was no longer set up to sustain that farm. That basically, they were forced into selling. And now in his generation, Daniel is working for the same farm, barely making it by, mm-hmm. that his grandfather had owned. The call came because he said, I've just been laid off, our medical bills are piling up, and meanwhile, my son is dealing drugs. Now, if you don't know this, wherever you see these old farms, very often in this case, they were chopped up into a cherry tree farm over here. There was an industrial chicken farm on the other part of the lot, the old lot.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me the story that whenever you see industrial chicken farming, you see crystal meth production.
Hmm.
And his son, he's saying to me, you know, the only way he could make money was selling drugs. he calls me because he says, the old prosperity gospel, this old notion that I was raised to believe, has failed me. And has God failed me? This is the lie of the prosperity gospel, that if you're not doing as well as your neighbor, if all of a sudden you, like so many Americans, are really seeing the end of that American dream, is God turning his back? Well, of course, I told him that this is not at all the case. God is refuting in these actions the old prosperity gospel as a lie, as something maybe even approaching a heresy. And so we need to go back, this is my argument to him, go back to the Bible itself. Go back to what Jesus says about the poor and the oppressed. Goes back to this idea of Jubilee in the Old Testament, that as a core of our spiritual tradition is a different kind of economy is being talked about. And going from the way we've used Christianity in the past 200 years, fair enough, it is kind of faltering. But more and more people, and, you know, especially with Pope Francis, I listened to your show last week with Sister Simone, we're seeing this revival. And that revival is showing up in so many ways. In a way, it's a return to Christianity. That is what has gotten me so excited these days.
Is this working with both young people and older people, or are just the young people getting it? How, what are you finding in your own community?
Well, in my community, I think you're seeing it across the board for the younger generations. The younger people who are coming up are the ones college educated into a world that no longer exists. They have huge debt. They have very few have any future prospects of retirement. These are the communities that are looking for a new kind of spiritual conversation in this country. But more and more and more, as I get calls across the country, I'm hearing it in the older generation as well. So certainly with our young people, you know, a few years ago, I played a big part with Occupy Wall Street. I co-founded Occupy Faith. And we used as a symbol of a golden calf that was in the shape of a Wall Street bull. And we tried to say that this outbreak from our young people around the country, this whole generational shift we're seeing towards a different kind of economic conversation, different kind of spiritual conversation, is not, in fact, something that is so far away from our core traditions. It's a return to our core traditions. And as more and more people, like my new friend Daniel, are calling in and saying that, you know, the old ways of living in this country aren't working anymore, they're coming back around. They're reading the Bible and our tradition with fresh eyes and recognizing that there is something radical here. And we've maybe been asleep. Maybe we were glancing over those parts of the Bible, but that it's become more relevant than it ever has been. And I can't tell you, I mean, I'm here in New York City. We have anarchists, and so, you know, we have all these, you know, abstract people and crazy ideas. And they're coming around more and more to very classical Christian values. And seeing that every day is a miracle to me and exciting.
Your take on that is one of the most positive ones I've heard, and you have the credentials to make that claim. What do you think has to happen for the essential work of justice finally to flower in the modern world?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've been focusing on the economy a little bit because I think it undergirds all the other social justice issues we encounter, the very setup of resources inside our society. And, you know, there was a report that came out this last week, I think it's from the Oxfam Group, that says that 85 of the wealthiest people on this planet hold as much wealth as the poorest 3.5 billion, or half the world population on this planet. Wealth disparity undergirds any conversation we're going to have about spirituality and the relevance of our traditions. So what you're asking in another frame is, what do people do about it? How do they connect that core spiritual value that I'm articulating with what's actually on the ground? I mean, one thing we can all start to do is to remind our elected officials that all budgets are moral documents, that there is no separate conversation of how we break down the budgets of our state, our country, maybe even our household, from what our core moral values are. And again, you know, if you go back to the Old Testament, you read books like Deuteronomy that a lot of people tend to just sort of glance over, that's all of what it's about. At the core of that entire conversation in Deuteronomy, it's asking, how do you treat the widows? How do you treat the immigrants? How do you treat the poor people in the society? It's all of their codes for the economic underdwellers of that society. And it says in that, of course, Jesus says it as well, that there is no community separate from how you treat them. That my liberation and my well-being cannot be divorced from the well-being of those who are suffering inside this system. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I experience my job as being easier and easier every day. People are coming with these questions and with these answers. And, you know, if anything, I see the gospel as more practically relevant than ever before, mm-hmm. as we look at these moral documents and are recognizing that our faith over here cannot be separated from the decisions we make in the real world, you know, in government, in our businesses, in our families. And seeing that shift is a remarkable one.
Michael, if I might ask, what has been your own journey as a faith leader? Do you come from a more traditional background?
You know, I'm the grandson of a Baptist minister, mm-hmm. and my uncle's a Baptist minister, and I'm actually ordained with the United Church of Christ, but I work at an American Baptist church, Judson, here mm-hmm. in the village. Mm-hmm. And I went through what a lot of young people did. You know, in high school, college, I really started to move away from the church. Never moved away from my faith in Jesus, but I certainly moved away from the church because of what I sensed and what I think everyone in my generation sensed to be the hypocrisy of the church. There was a period of time there in college and maybe even 2 years out of college where I thought, what is the relevancy of this? Because all I was hearing was people using faith as a platform for hatred and oppression. And, you know, the example of this that we use a lot here at Judson is, we will go to culture war in this country over two obscure bits in the Bible that people interpret as God being anti-gay.
Yeah.
But we will take something like immigration policy. The number one commandment in the Old Testament is to honor the stranger in your mix.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, where are all those same fundamentalists? Where are all those same Christian values on issues of immigration?
Yeah.
Or, as I've been saying all along, issues of economics? So I turn my back away. But I went to seminary to do it, and part of my journey was going to Union Theological Seminary, one of the fine institutions in this country.
Yes.
And by the time I was done, I felt re-outfitted in a new way. And I recognized that if we're going to maintain the spiritual validity of these traditions, we can't roll over and let someone else articulate them for us. We've got to stand up and say what's core, remind people what's core. And so, like a lot of people, I came back and decided, you know, this is my calling, to deal with the poor and oppressed in our own times. And that's what revitalizes the church.
Yes.
We are a church that's been growing by leaps and bounds, and young people, and there's a lot of diversity at Judson right now, a lot of excitement. But I attribute all of it to us going back to the core.
Mm-hmm.
Luke chapter 4, verse 18, Jesus talks about the great spirit is upon him, because he is here to preach the good news to the poor and oppressed. And that spirit, once people realize that you are connecting the old traditions with the new spirit of serving the poor, the oppressed, people can tell that you're the real thing. That has revitalized me. It's revitalized our church. And I'm of the opinion that we're seeing it now revitalize our country.
Talk about some of the specific programs at Judson Memorial Church that you're excited about that generate more excitement in you.
Well, there's so much going on here. I mean, we're a big part of the new sanctuary movement for immigrant rights. There's a new movement here at Judson to talk about reproductive rights. My own part of it is what we kind of blanket call the new economy work.
Mm-hmm.
We're recognizing more and more, as wealth disparity increases in our country, we're trying to figure out here every day, how do we take the resources we have right here in our economy and take care of each other? Instead of waiting for top-down change to occur, instead of waiting for our policymakers to catch up what I think so many of our churches and synagogues and mosques are already doing, here at Judson and a lot of places like Judson in New York City and across the country are starting their own economy. There are timeshares that are emerging. There are credit unions that are coming out. You know, one of my great teachers for this is Gary Simpson at Concord Baptist Church in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And in so many ways, the African-American church is just years and years ahead of us. Because, you know, 20 years ago beyond this, they were recognizing that if the capital is pulling out of our community, if more and more people that can't get the jobs, can't get the resources, if the government is cutting all these programs, even while giving money away to the rich, how do we deal with it? And so we're looking at our own credit union. One of the things we did recently is pull our a lot of our money out of some of the bigger banks and invest it here in the Lower East Side Credit Union. Hmm. People see us doing this kind of thing, and it's the good news they're waiting for. People are frustrated and tired of waiting for our government to catch up to this. Hmm. And that is where the real excitement happens.
What's the most fulfilling part of your work?
Oh, my God. Giving hope to people.
Yeah.
People who walk in here and say, I need something concrete. I need a new blender. I need clothes for a job interview. People are seeing the bottom drop out of our culture in so many ways. There's so much struggle for work. We get to be the people to say that we're not going to add one more problem to your list. We're going to add solutions to your list.
Mm.
A couple years ago, we partnered with a group here in New York called the Really, Really Free Market. Mm. And, you know, once a month, we hold this big festival here, where everyone brings the things they're given away, and it's not just my old blender or an old suit or whatever. It's also services. There's someone who gives dentistry work at the Really, Really Free Market. There's people who are given haircuts. And when I have these people come through my office and I see the burden of what the world is doing to them, I can see what it's like to be working three jobs and have no time with your kids. Our Christian message is useless if not wedded to our Christian practice.
Right.
And so that is my excitement every day, is living it and learning how in the 21st century to be the real thing. You know, for 10,000 years, we repeat the words of the gospel and of Jesus, and it becomes nothing more than ideas that we can bandy around, and you have your opinion, I have my opinion. It can be used in all sorts of ways, but grounding it in the example of Jesus, grounding it in the way he built community and finding ways of doing that, that is the hope of the gospel lived out in the here and now. And when I see someone come through here and see their whole orientation to the world turn itself around, this is when I think to myself, I've got the greatest job in the world. And I feel so blessed to be able to get up every day. And I'm also, you know, everyone who goes to seminary has a seminarian's debt. And we're always struggling, my wife and I, how are we going to pay the bills? How are we going to raise children? And what kind of school are they going to? But the faith of God comes through the hands and hearts of my friends and this community. And that is where I get up every day with a smile on my face and think, this is why we're doing it. This is the kingdom of heaven as a beloved community in the here and now. And, you know, there's times where you think, oh, no one's doing this, and how do we get ahead of this? But then I get calls from people, churches, who hear about something we're doing from all over the country, and I realize this is happening. This is happening all over the place, and it's exciting to be part of.
The Reverend Michael Ehlich is minister at Judson Memorial Church in New York City. As a young faith leader and theologian, he is one of the voices you're going to be hearing a lot from in the year ahead. Michael, I really thank you for all that you're doing, for the way you're doing it, the spirit in which you're doing it, and also for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Hey, it is my pleasure, and thank you so much for hosting these conversations, not just with me, but with so many of my friends and colleagues and heroes. You are so valuable to us and what you're doing, and we thank you for it.
State of Belief would like to acknowledge the partnership of Auburn Seminary and the support of the May and Samuel Rudin Family Foundation in New York for the conversation with the Reverend Michael Ehlich on this week's show, a part of a month of conversations with faith leaders most likely to frame the critical justice debates of 2014. On next week's installment of this series, A Prophetic Vision for a New Year, Where We're Going, How We'll Get There, I'll be talking with Sikh filmmaker and activist Valerie Carr. We'll also go deeper into the subject of what's next for the Progressive Faith Movement for Justice with a diverse panel of influential expert voices. When the article titled, I Was an Angry Atheist, Why I Launched and Relaunched on Faith, appeared online this week, I knew one who wrote it, and I knew that it was time to have her back on State of Belief Radio, Sally Quinn. I am so glad to be talking with you again.
Well, I am so happy to be talking with you. You've been one of my mentors for a long time, you know.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, but and it's also a risk for you to say that.
Well, I don't think I could have launched On Faith without your help, Wilson.
Well, thank you. With the promise to relaunch On Faith, you've published this compelling article where you summarize so articulately the fact that Americans can't avoid the influence of religion in lives, like it or not. Would you start, Sally, with that?
Well, I think, you know, when I started this website, it was 7.5 years ago. I didn't know anything about religion. And I'd see some guy in a collar and a priest or a minister or something, and I'd run the other way because I didn't know what to talk to them about. You know, I saw them as the other.
That still doesn't mean you might not ought to run away.
Right. I have one friend, a minister in Washington, who said that he'd go to parties and nobody would talk to him. And finally, one night, he went to a party in a coat and tie. And when he was asked what he did, he said he was a private detective. And suddenly, everybody was talking to him, and they all wanted to know what he did. When I started the website, I really started to learn about other people's faiths and, you know, that their customs, their cultures, their dress, their food, their everything. And, you know, there's an argument about all people of faith, all religions are the same, and ultimately the basic tenets of most religions mm-hmm. are the same, which is that you look after your fellow man and you take care of the poor and you treat people the way you want to be treated. I mean, it's all about the golden rule.
Yeah.
So it's just that they have a different way of basically what I call getting through the night,
that's
you know?
Right. That's right.
Because that's what religion is. Religion is there to be a comfort.
Will you say just a word about what was a part of On Faith?
It was to let everyone have a voice. The old On Faith was with the Washington Post. It was more like an op-ed page. You mm-hmm. know, people wrote in about different things. I mean, as I said in my piece, religion is about everything. It's about sex. Yes. It's about politics. I mean, look at the last election. Look at foreign policy, the Sunnis, the Shiites. If you're interested in education, if you're interested in immigration or same-sex marriage or abortion, you can't understand history or art or philosophy or music without understanding religion or even pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
It so infuses our culture. The idea that people would say, I'm not interested in religion, is you can't say that because,
no.
of course, it touches almost everything we do on some level.
Absolutely. Tell us the difference between what was uh-huh. On Faith and what is going to be.
What we want to do now is more of sort of long form. If you look at the site, we're going to have theme weeks. And so our launch week this week is Presidents and Their Faith.
Mm-hmm.
And we have 5 fantastic pieces. We started on Monday, which was Martin Luther King Day, and we had Joshua Dubois, who was mm-hmm. President Obama's spiritual advisor, write a piece about Martin Luther King and his effect on Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And then John Meacham, who's the famous religion scholar and historian, did a piece about Jefferson and his faith. Michael Beschloss mm-hmm. has a piece on how presidents use religion. Diana Butler Bass is writing about the history of religion and the presidency. And then on Friday, we have Lawrence Wright, who's a New Yorker writer, mm-hmm. writing about Camp David. He's just done a play about it and how religion played a role in Camp David with Jimmy Carter and Begin and Sadat.
Yeah.
So that's our first week, and it's a pretty good lineup. But what it does is it takes one issue like religion mm-hmm. and the presidency and explores it in a little more depth. It's not opinions
yes.
as much as it is sort of stories
right.
and pieces. And then we're going to have a lot more features. We'll have op-ed type pieces, mm-hmm. and we're going to have stories about people who, one of the features we're starting is getting people to go to a church, synagogue, or some sort of spiritual gathering and write about their experience, something that's not what they usually do. Next week, we're going to do football and religion because it's the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
We're going to do a week on sex and religion. We'll probably do a lot of those weeks because... But, I mean, it's a huge issue in
sure.
most faiths. We're going to do a week on the Pope, Roma Downey and Mark Burnett. He's the Hollywood producer who does The Voice and Survivor.
Mm-hmm.
They did a huge 12-part series on the Bible on History Channel last spring,
right?
Which got more ratings in the history of anything in the world. I mean, it was just extraordinary. And they've now done a film on Jesus called Son of God. And so we're going to do a whole week on Jesus based around their film, and I'm going to be doing a video interview with them.
Right.
They'll be in Washington.
Well, I'm going to tell you what, this sounds very, very exciting. And I hear in your voice an enthusiasm that I may not have heard since you started on Faith to begin with.
Right. Well,
and
I can't tell you how excited I am.
I can tell.
And I mean, the idea that, you know, that something like this would work, and it will. I mean, I believe that this it's going to be hugely successful. I mean, as a not only financially, but I think just editorially. We have a brilliant new editor, Patton Dodd. You may know him. He's kind of a superstar in the religion world, and he's just wonderful to work with. And we've got this great team, and you know, we're just, you know, the main thing, Welton, we're having fun.
That's great.
It's really fun. It, I mean, there is nothing more exciting. I don't know a better conversation than religion, than what's the meaning of life, than spirituality. I mean, I think we're all looking for a sense of meaning in our lives. You know, we all want, even if you're not a believer, you want to be able to have transcendent moments. You want a sense of the divine in your life. And that's what we want to help people achieve.
I think you're going to do that. Sally Quinn is a longtime Washington Post columnist whose work at the On Faith section has made a significant contribution to interreligious dialogue in our nation. That work continues with the relaunch of On Faith. You can go to it at faithstreet.com. Sally, thanks so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Okay, thanks so much, Welton.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. We can only produce this show with the generous support of listeners like you. Please visit stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution to State of Belief today. We'll use it wisely to keep this program on the air and to expand the outreach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. Stateofbelief.com is where you can find out more about the show. You can hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. How we would like that. Stay in touch with us, please, throughout the week on Facebook and on Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. Our listener line is 202-681-4246. We encourage you to tell others about the show. We encourage you to encourage them to listen to the show. We'd like to add more people, more participants to this ongoing conversation. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. A very interesting panel. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.